Oh, happy to be here. Thank you, Professor. And thanks for all of you who have shown me around and taken care of me and made sure I got here safely. That was it was really helpful. And I'm having a great time. So I want you to start by imagining that you painted or collaged that painting, which is called something. What? Heart infection. Is that right? Right. So imagine you did that, right? And someone comes up to you and says, you know, I think that's super. I would like to, license the intellectual property rights for that work in some subsequent work, right? You know, I'm going to use, I want to, have it as a backdrop in a movie. You know, I want to include it in a play, whatever, right? I want to do something with it, create some derivative work. I want to make it, put it in a YouTube video where all the things are going to move, whatever, right? And they're going to license it from you. How do you figure out what the license fee should be? Right? What kinds of thought processes should you engage in to figure out the license fee for it? This is a central question for intellectual property law. Much of intellectual property ends up being transferred multiple times, right? So if you think about the creations of authors, those often have to be licensed by publishers and by others. The works of musicians are often licensed. There are lots of situations in which intellectual property, which is created by some author or inventor, has to go through multiple hands before it ends up coming into, entering the world. Right, or it enters the world in many different ways, right, through derivative works and the rest, right? The way intellectual property law thinks about these questions is rooted in conceptions and notions of behavior that are derived from neoclassical economics. Intellectual property law in the United States, and as far as I know, in Britain as well, tends to think about the ways people make decisions the way that economics says that people make decisions, right? They say that people are basically engaged in rational choice decision making, right? People weigh the values, the benefits and the costs of behaviors, and they try to assess how well that's going to go for them, what the utility is, and they assign some monetary value to it. The ways in which people do this are perfectly rational, right? It doesn't mean they're perfectly brilliant, right? But that they're rational about it. Intellectual property law tracks this in many respects. Over the course of the past 15 or 20 years, many of the central features of rational choice models of decision making have been substantially undermined by developments in the social sciences, particularly in fields like psychology, behavioral economics, judgment and decision making research, things like that. Right, these fields have suggested, research in these fields have suggested that people aren't the kind of rational actors that classical law and economics say they are, right? In fact, people are at best boundedly rational, right? They are capable of making rational decisions, but not the way that economics says. In fact, they seem to be subject to a number of systematic emotional and cognitive biases that distort the way they make decisions, distort their preferences, and distort their behaviors. Right? So over the course of the last 15 or 20 years, this type of research has shown that people don't do a good job of predicting what will make them happy, that they are substantially affected by anchors and frames, and a variety of other things like that. Perhaps the most important finding from this literature is that the ownership of goods exerts a really important and substantial frame on how people value those goods, right? So this is research that comes out of studies of what is known as the endowment effect. You guys heard of the endowment effect? Okay, so the endowment effect, right? So the endowment effect is this body of research which says that people tend to value things substantially more when they own them than when they're contemplating buying them, right? The classic study was done by Richard Thaler 20-something years ago now. Right, so Thaler went up to, had a class of business students, this was when he was at Cornell, right, and he gave out mugs that had the Cornell logo on them to a big class of 100 students. Except he only gave them out to half of the students, right? So he gives out these mugs to half of the students in the class, and not the other half, right? And he tells the half of the students who get the mugs, the person next to you is going to make an offer for your mug. You should state the least amount of money that you would be willing to accept to sell your mug to the person next to you, right? And then he tells the students without the mugs, you now get to make an offer for the person next to you's mug. How much would you be willing to pay? State the most amount of money that you would be willing to pay to buy that person's mug, right? Okay, so what does rational choice economics predict, right? There's no reason to think that the people who got the mugs are going to like them any different from the people who didn't get the mugs, right? Like, they're just mugs, right? People like them the way they like mugs, right? You know, drink coffee out of them, you put pencils in them, whatever, right? Mug. Mug's worth about $5, right? So what should you find? You should find that the average of the buyers and the average of the sellers is about $5, right? And that half of the mugs should change hands. Right? Because there's no reason to think that, you know, just because you got the mug and you didn't get the mug, right, that you're going to love the mug, right? You know, you might like coffee, you might not like coffee, so you'll keep the mug. Or she might like coffee and you might not, and so you'll trade, right? So half of the mug should change hands, and it should do so at the price, which is pretty consistent between buyers and sellers, right? This is not what happens, right? So this is what happens. In fact, right, so buyers are basically rational. The people who don't get the mug say, well, mug's worth about $5, right? I guess I'd pay about $5 for it. Right, that's what a mug is worth. On the other hand, the sellers think much more highly of the mug all of a sudden. Right, the sellers say, I'm unwilling to sacrifice this mug for any less than $8 on average. Right, out of a class of 100 students, right, you know, or 100 mugs, where, you know, 50 of them should change hands, only about 15 of them do. Right? The people who get the mugs like the mugs a lot more. All of a sudden, right? They didn't like mugs before, right? No reason to think that there's anything special about them, right? But all of a sudden, they've been endowed with the mug, and they think, boy, this mug is fantastic. Think of all the great things I could do with it. I could drink coffee out of it, and put pencils in it, and collect change in it, right? And they really, all of a sudden, start to love the mug. So what we see here is that the market for things, even as simple as mugs, are substantially sticky when it comes to the distribution of goods, right? According to, right, everyone, the Coase theorem, you guys study the Coase theorem, right? The Coase theorem is this, you know, one of these foundational principles of rational choice economics, which says it doesn't matter how you distribute goods. In a world of zero transaction costs, they'll distribute exactly the way they should. The people who value them the most will end up getting them. The people who value them the least won't have them, right? So in a world of mugs or hunting permits or, you know, environmental clean air, right? If people value it, doesn't matter how you distribute it, they will just be transferred easily to the people who value them the most, right? This work on the endowment effect suggests that that's not true. It suggests that the initial distribution of any type of property right or good will be incredibly sticky. It will tend to stay with the people to whom it was initially distributed. Right? This means there will be lots of potentially welfare-enhancing, potentially efficient transactions that will tend not to be made due to this initial distribution. Right? So the first study was with mugs. Actually, the first reason they first saw this in the realm of hunting permits, it turns out, right? So, you know, when they asked these people, you know, how much would you be willing to pay for a hunting permit? They're like, yeah, I don't know, $50, $25, whatever, right? But when you give someone a hunting permit, like, how much would we have to pay you to give back your hunting permit? Or how much would you sell it to this guy down the block? They're like, I don't know, $250. You're not getting my hunting permit, right? You'll have to pry it out of my cold, dead hands. Right, that's what people say about guns in America. Presumably, they say it about hunting permits too. So this is the right. So they saw a lot of this stuff in the wild, and then these psychologists, these behavioral economists, brought it into the lab, and they started studying it in the lab. So now it's been shown for mugs and pencils, environmental permits, all of these kinds of things. Right, this substantial gap between what buyers are willing to pay to acquire goods and what owners are willing to sell them for. Right. So the magnitude of the effect, though, can be quite different. There are a variety of things that can affect the magnitude. If we, instead of handing out mugs, handed out pound coins, right? Would there be any effect? No, right? Like, a pound coin is worth a pound coin. Everyone knows that, right? You're willing to sell it for a pound and buy it for a pound, right? So you don't see it for things like that. What you see it for, you know, usually more highly, are things that have some type of personal attachment. If you feel like you've earned the good in some way, the magnitude of the effect seems to go up. For things that don't have obvious market value, the effect goes up, right? So this gap in willingness to accept and willingness to pay is particularly high for environmental goods where there are no market prices, for things like personal health and safety, right? It turns out people are not willing to accept very much money for the loss of an arm. On the other hand, they're also not willing to pay very much to protect their arms, right? So they want a lot of money. If you ask them, like, here's a, here's a suitcase full of cash, right? Will you take this for your arm? They say no, right? But then, you know, when they say, you know, well, will you wear a seatbelt that will protect your arm? They're like, nah, right? So you see these very big differences in these kinds of things. So we had read these studies, and it occurred to us that this could have interesting implications for intellectual property law. And we thought about this in a number of different ways. So one of the things we said was, you know, from all of this research that suggests that this, the magnitude of the effect is stronger when the good feels earned or attached or emotional in some way, it's likely to be higher for goods that are created by people. So that suggests even a higher effect associated with it rather, you know, than just with merely owned goods. But then we thought intellectual property is different in some ways, too. When you license intellectual property or sell your intellectual property rights, you're not selling the thing itself. So in some ways, the alienation is incomplete, right? If you sell your mug is gone, right? If you sell your IP, you still keep your painting. You just lose the opportunity to gain rents off of it, right? And it's non-rival, right? I can still look at my painting even though I've sold you the IP rights. So it's an incomplete alienation. It's non-rival in some ways. So maybe the effect could be smaller. So we wanted to test these things, right? We wanted to see what kinds of effects we would get. So unlike the standard market for the standard markets for things like mugs where you transfer the good, we had to figure out a way where people were actually transferring something that looked like IP rights. So what we did is we brought people in and we put them into various contests, right? So our first experiment was a contest for haikus, right? So we got a bunch of people together. These were mostly undergraduate students at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. So we got together undergraduate students at the University of Virginia, and we brought them in, and we said, we're going to hold a contest for haikus. One out of every 10 haikus, you're going to be competing with 9 other people in this contest for a $50 prize, right? Please write the best haiku that you can, because you can win this prize. So we have these people write these haikus for the contest. Then we tell them, we're going to bring in another set of subjects, and we're going to give them a chance to buy your haiku from you, right? They're going to make up a number. They're going to come up with a number that's going to be the most that they'd be willing to pay to buy your haikus, but not your haiku, right? Only its chance to win the prize. We'll still print off your haiku, and we'll give it to you when you leave, right? The only thing they're buying from you is the chance to win the prize with that haiku. Right? So you should indicate what's the least amount of money that you'd be willing to sell it for. Right? And if these two things overlap, you're going to change places. Right? You'll get their cash offer, and they'll get your chance to win the prize. Right? And you go on with your cash and your haiku, right? And they kind of step into your shoes. Right? So we've set up, you know, kind of the basic endowment effect study. Right? We've got, you know, the creators on one side, the owners on one side, and we've got the buyers on the other. Right? But we wanted to figure out something else. Right? We didn't want to just differentiate between them. We wanted to see if we could differentiate between the creators and mere owners, right? People to whom we assigned a haiku and said, this is yours for purposes of this contest. If it wins the prize, you get to win the prize, right? You get the $50. How much would you be willing to sell your chance to win the prize for? Does that make sense? Right? So now we have three separate groups of people, right? We have the creators of the haiku, the writers, right? We have the mere owners, and then we have the buyers, right? So what do we expect? We thought, you know, there's some possibility this creation bit is going to affect the magnitude of their value, right? So we thought, you know, if creating the thing matters to people, then what we're going to see is creator valuation, right, the amount that they're willing to sell for, higher than owner valuation, which will be yet higher than bidder valuation. Does that make sense? Right, so the creators are going to, you know, not be willing to part with this for the most, right? That's going to be higher than the owners, and that's going to be higher than the bidders. So, you know, so goes science. We didn't see it, right? What we did see was authors and owners are basically the same. Authors and owners in this case valued the chance to win the prize at about $20, right? Whereas bidders were, you know, lower than that, right? So we see, and these are statistically significant at the p equals 0.5 or 0.05 level, right? So, you know, significant difference. No difference between authors and owners, but a big difference between those two and the buyers, right? The buyers say, well, that's an okay poem, right? You know, it's got a decent chance of winning. I guess I'm willing to pay a decent amount of money to win, right? They're actually a little irrational, right? I mean, their number should be what? 5. Right, because you got a 1 in 10 chance of winning $50. So on average, that should be about 5, because it's a zero-sum game, right? Some of them are going to be a little better, some of them are going to be a little worse. I have reasons why I think that's higher, if you're interested, right? But in any event, right, these are much higher, right? So what we're seeing here, at least, is some degree of kind of inefficiency of markets, or at least some indication that the markets might be inefficient. Okay, so why didn't we see the gap between authors and owners? We had a couple of possibilities. One was that these were not, you know, intrinsically motivated creators. We brought people in and said, write a haiku. And they're like, okay, right? And two, writing a haiku is not a really big creative investment. You know, the haikus were actually pretty good, but people wrote them in about 3 to 4 or 5 minutes, something like that, right? It's a 3-line poem, right? You can write a haiku pretty quickly. They're pretty good, but it's not like a task. So we thought maybe if we ran this study again with creators who were internally motivated and had some substantial creative investment in what they were doing, we would see a difference. So experiment 2 attempted to do just that. Here we brought in painting students from the Art Institute in Chicago. These were undergraduate and graduate students in painting courses. This is kind of what they wanted to do professionally, right? And we had them bring in a medium-sized painting for a contest. This time the contest was for $100 rather than $50, and there was a 1 in 10 chance of winning. And we did exactly the same thing, right? We said, how much would you be willing to sell your painting's chance to win the prize for? We had a group of owners come in. We said, for purposes of this contest, this is your painting. How much would you be willing to sell its chance to win the prize for? And then at the bottom, we had the buyers again, right? Again, we still had the buyers. We said, how much are you willing to pay to buy that poem's, that painting's chance to win? And voila, right, we saw it. Right, so finally, here we go. So this is what we end up with, right? Painters, on average, are unwilling to sell their 1 in 10 chance to win a $100 prize for $74, right? That's the minimum amount of money that they're willing to accept to sell a 1 in 10 chance to win a $100 prize. That seems kind of irrational, right? Like, it's a 1 in 10 chance. I mean, it's a weighted 1 in 10 chance. I mean, you might have a greater painting, worse painting, right? But substantially irrational. If, remember, the right answer, right, the answer that economists tell you is the right answer is $10, right? 1 in 10 chance of a $100 prize is worth statistically $10, right? Owners, right, they're a little, you know, they're better, right? They're basically where we saw them last time, right? They're irrational, but not nearly as irrational as painters. And buyers are, again, about where we saw them last time. Right, you know, they're basically right around where they should be. They're a little high, and again, I have reasons why. Right, so now we see this gap. Right, now we see this difference between the creators on the one hand and the owners on the other. Right, and they're both different from the buyers. This gap between the painters and the owners, right, between 40 and 74, is what we're calling the creativity effect. Right, this enhanced endowment effect that comes from having created the goods themselves, right, rather than merely owning them. So this is what we've got, right? These are our findings. Question is, though, where do they come from? Right, because if we want to do something about this from the perspective of law and policy, it's important for us to understand what's motivating them. Right, there might be good reasons to do this. Right, there might be good reasons to overvalue your work. There might be bad reasons. So we wanted to figure out what those reasons were. We had a number of different ideas. Right, one possibility was emotional attachment. They are emotionally attached to their work and don't want to let it go. Another is some kind of labor theory, right? People feel like they've put a lot of work into it and don't want to let it go. We thought maybe regret aversion, right? What we mean by this is people were anxious about selling the painting that ended up winning, right? And feeling bad about having sold the painting that ended up winning and thus kind of charging some additional amount of money to avoid feeling that regret, right? So if I'm going to sell this painting and it's going to win and you're going to win with it, you're going to have to pay me an extra $5, or in this case, maybe a lot more. Right, and then the last one was optimism. People just like their stuff. Okay, so what did we find? We found effectively nothing for emotional attachment. Right, there's seemingly no difference between, you know, the valuations for painters who declared high emotional attachment versus ones who declared low emotional attachment. We found no role for labor. Right, so regardless of the amount of time you spent, you know, painting your painting, there was no difference in the valuation. The two things we did find mostly are regret, right? So you see regret seems to be playing some role, right? People seem to be anxious, and that's significant at the 0.10 level, but not quite the 0.05 level, the difference between painters and owners and buyers. But mostly what we see is this over-optimism, right? So there are the probabilities, right? You ask painters, what are the chances are that your painting is going to win this contest with 9 of the paintings in it? About 50-50, right? You know, it's about even odds that I'm going to win this thing, right? And there's the quality, right? Why? Because it's freaking awesome, right? You know, because my painting is really, really fantastic, and all the other paintings are kind of dreadful, right? So why should I sell my painting for anything less than $74, right? I mean, that's most of the value of the, that's exactly what I think is going to happen, right? Notice, obviously, I mean, this is not to suggest that people are actually good at probabilities and you should count these as, like, right? People don't understand probabilities, right? What you should get, I think, is, though, the relative difference in the probabilities, right? So not that I think they really think it's half, but I think, you know, we can at least say they think it's statistically more likely than do the painters and the owners, right? Does that make sense? Any questions about any of this so far? Okay, so this is what we've got, right? So what we've got is that, you know, this major effect due to over-optimism, right? This, you know, in the States we call it the Lake Wobegon effect, where all the children are above average, right? You know, and this is what happens when you ask people, are you an above average driver, right? You know, and, you know, 98% of the people say they're above average drivers, right? This is kind of what's going on here, right? Except, you know, it's about the same. Are you an above average? What's that?
It's implicitly not going on with haiku.
We saw some of it going on in the haiku as well. But for whatever reason, it wasn't translating into the valuation difference. So I'm not really sure why. We actually ran the haiku study in another way, where we had not a contest, but a lottery. And we saw probability gaps there, too. So even though we told them, one of these haikus will be drawn at random, what are your chances of winning, right? 10%, right? I don't know, 35%, 40%. And they thought they were more likely to be drawn at random if they had written it than if you had, like, people don't really get probability, right? And, you know, the people are strange with probability, let's say. People have a variety of clever ways of thinking about probability that aren't necessarily what economists think. Okay, so what should we do about this if we're the law? If we've got these ways of understanding, now we've got some sense of what people do, right? And it's not what economists say they do. Right? Economists say, you know, the markets for intellectual property, just like markets for everything else, should be basically rational, right? And the initial distribution of goods shouldn't matter all that much, right? We'll give them to the authors because, you know, probably authors are in a good position to figure out what they like about them, right? The transaction costs of giving them to the authors are probably the lowest, but it really doesn't matter at the end of the day because, you know, transaction costs, they'll move through markets exactly the way they're supposed to. If a filmmaker wants to use your song in his film, if another company wants to use your patent in their new product, then those licenses will be relatively easy to negotiate because you will both have rational estimates about the value of the work, right? So this is not what we see, right? We see a market that is potentially quite inefficient. Right, lots of potentially efficient and welfare-maximizing transactions that aren't being made simply because the people who have created those goods have an inflated sense of their quality and their value. Right? So what should we do? Well, we've got a number of different ideas, none of which we want to say are like the right idea. Right? You know, with things like with things like this, it all is kind of a matter of costs and benefits, right? You know, some of these might be more valuable, some of them might be less valuable, right? But I think the point is they can't be merely questions of ideology, right? That clearly. So one of the things we suggest is maybe intellectual property should switch from forms of property rule protection to liability rule protection. I don't know if this is like a big distinction in Britain, right? But it goes back to the ways in which certain types of rights are protected. When they're protected by property rights, then the owner of those rights sets their value, and you can't take those rights from them unless you pay whatever the owner insists upon. Right? And if you do, then you're responsible potentially for treble damages or something like that, right? This is what intellectual property law looks like in the States. Liability rules are different, right? In liability rules, you can take, and all you have to do is pay what effectively the court says is a reasonable price, Right? So the court sets the price of goods, and if you want to take them, you take them and just pay whatever the court says is a reasonable price. Right? This is how we think of the value of arms, right? And the value of lots of things. Right? If you want to take an arm, you take it, and then you just pay whatever the arm is worth, right? Subject to criminal prosecution and all of the rest. Right? But you know, so one of the things we think is that if we switch from property rules to liability rules, there's good reason to think that the values associated with these things would, you know, the substantial valuation anomaly would go away. So there's some work that suggests that when rights and goods are protected by liability rules rather than property rules, the endowment effect diminishes or goes away entirely. Right? So we thought maybe if we did a switch like that, we could get rid of some substantial portion of the endowment effect that we're seeing. Another possibility is to include some kind of formalities, right? At least if people, you know, if people are going to substantially overvalue their goods, at least make them kind of clear some degree of hurdle in order to get that property rule protection, right? I mean, obviously there are potential problems with this with respect to burn and all the rest, right? But at least one could think cleverly about how one might want to do that if you're anxious about these types of anomalies. A third thing that we've contemplated is thinking about fair use. If to some extent fair use seems to be about efficient market transactions, at least this is one theory of fair use that has some prominence in the States. If we think that market transactions aren't all that efficient, we might think that a lot more uses should be fair. Right? If people aren't able to successfully bargain to them, well, maybe the specter of a fair use judgment will help them bargain to a more efficient outcome. Something like that, right? We've thought about using intermediaries. There are a variety of possibilities in all of these cases, right? And at the end, we're not obviously convinced that any of them is right, but they're all possible. So we have one last set of questions that we wanted to ask, and it's the last study I want to tell you about. We thought, well, in all of these studies, all we care about are economic value, right? The pecuniary value you get from owning intellectual property rights. Wonder what happens if we try and measure the other types of things that people may care about. So people seem to think that folks care about publication, right? I have created something, I want it out there so that my ideas are out there, right? I want my scientific research to exist so the world knows it's out there. I want my poem to exist so that people can read it and know, you know, what a great genius I am. They may also want attribution. They might want some reputational gain, right? I want, you know, my name to be out there, you know, regardless of the money that I can get for it, because I value attribution. I value whatever reputation comes along with publishing this work. So we figured we could do that, right? We can measure how much people seem to value attribution in publication. So we set up the study that would attempt to do that. Right? We set up three conditions. This time we didn't have buyers and owners, right? All we had were creators, right? So everyone is in the creator condition here, right? But we had creators who were offered three different types of things, right? They were all told the same thing. Someone is going to come in and make an offer for your chance to win a contest. This time it was photographs, and the value of the contest was $1,000. Right, for 100 subjects. So still keeping the same estimated value of $10, right? But you know, much bigger prize this time. As we said, someone's gonna come in and buy your chance to win, right? But we told them different things. So the first ones were told everything that the other ones were told before, right? You know, if you win, you get the prize, right? You know, if you sell, then you get the cash and the other person gets the prize, right? Condition two was told something different. They were told, if you sell, right, if you make a successful transaction with this buyer and your photograph wins, it will be published on a major website like the Huffington Post or the New York Times, right, without your name, right? We're going to put your name, you know, photograph up there, and it's going to say, you know, winner of the contest or something like that, right? The third group was told, if you sell and your photograph wins the prize, it will be published on one of these major websites with your name. Right, so the second condition we're calling like just the publication condition. The third condition we're calling the publication plus attribution condition. Right, and the first we're calling just the contest or the cash condition. Does that make sense? Right, and so what do we think? Well, we think if people value publication and if they value attribution, then the cash condition should be the highest. Right, so what we've given them is we've given them some incentive to decrease their willingness to accept to increase the likelihood they're going to make a transaction. Right, so if you value these things, you should decrease the amount of money that you're asking so that you increase your likelihood of ending up published. Right, so this is what it should look like if people value those things in this way. Right, we're not sure if they did. Right, we wanted to see if we run the study and see if we could pick it up. Right, so first we ran the study with 200 subjects on Amazon Mechanical Turk, which is a way of kind of getting more or less normal people to contribute to a study. It's used for lots of things. This is what we were using it for. And we asked for kind of aspiring photographers, you know, aspiring serious amateur photographers. I don't know how, you know, what kind of sample we got with respect to that. You know, we asked them some demographic questions. Hard to tell how much, you know, if, whether they were telling the truth. Right, so we ran it with them, and this is what we got. The data aren't, you know, entirely conclusive, but what we do get is if you combine the cache and publication conditions, and I think even if you don't, they are substantially higher than the publication plus name condition, the attribution condition at the p equals 0.05 level, right? So the opportunity to get attribution substantially diminishes people's willingness to accept compared to the just cache condition or the, you know, the cache plus publication condition, right? Why is the publication condition higher? A, I don't know. B, I have a theory. One possibility is that people don't like their stuff being published without their without attribution, right? So if you look at Creative Commons licenses, for a while they offered a, you know, a license that had no attribution attached to it. And no one ever used it, because people want their name on stuff. So they never used it, and so they did away with the license. So it's possible here that people just are averse to publication without attribution, more averse to just the cache. So that's one possibility, or it could just be an artifact of the study. So we ran the study again, this time with professional and serious amateur photographers, most of whom spent at least 10 hours a week on photography. The sample size was much smaller, so the data aren't quite as good, but at least we're getting to the kinds of people we want. So when we ran it with them, it ended up looking a lot like what we thought it would look like, right? Here, I mean, the differences are not as significant as we would like them to be, in part because the sample sizes are pretty small, because it's really hard to get these people to do anything. But you know, you see basically what you think, right? Publication is worth is worth more to them than just the cash, and publication plus attribution is worth the most, right? They really care about that. Note, however, they're still pretty irrational. Right, you know, the amount of money that they're willing to accept here to sell a, you know, 1 in 100 chance at a $1,000 prize is extraordinarily high, right? So although there is some diminution in what we expect is the creativity effect, it certainly isn't making it go away, right? It certainly is not leading to what we can think and feel confident are really efficient markets. These are the data combined where you see, you know, the big difference between 1 and 2 on the one hand and 3, and that's a rather significant result. So this is what we've done. So what do we think about this? What are the implications of this data? Tough to say, right? I mean, one is that, well, people value attribution, and they value publication maybe, but they don't seem to value it enough to completely eradicate the, you know, the creativity effect that we've shown previously. Another possibility is that we should think about including some type of attribution right in the types of, you know, bundle of rights we give people. And there are kind of two ways of thinking about this. One, maybe we should give it to them because they value it. Two, maybe we shouldn't give it to them because they value it. You know, so if we give it to them because they value it, well, you know, we're diminishing transaction costs, right? These people value it, we should give them the right because they value it. So we diminish the transaction costs associated with them transacting over getting attribution. Well, on the other hand, if we don't give it to them, we give them some incentive to bargain over it. Right? We give them some incentive to take a lot less cash in order to, you know, circulate their stuff, to get some attribution. And so if we're really worried about the creativity effect part of it, right, maybe we shouldn't be giving them attribution at all, right? Because maybe that's going to lead to a substantially higher number of bargains, right, at least over the cash part of it, because we've given them some because they have to bargain now over the attribution, right? So now, you know, you're contemplating selling this painting, right? And some, you know, you get an offer from one person and they say, here's $1,000, right? And someone else says, well, you know, we'll publish it for we'll only give you $800, but we'll put your name on it, right? We'll give you a credit. Well, maybe we want a lot of people taking that second option because we end up with more efficient results. We end up with people bargaining when they might not otherwise would be.
$10.
Because, yeah, it's a 1 in 100 out of 1,000. So we tried to keep the expected value of all these things the same. So it should have always been 10 in all of those situations. People don't understand probabilities, is the basic result. So that's, you know, basically all I'm here to present. I can talk about what we're going to do in the future if you want. You know, I'm happy to have any questions about any of this. So thanks so much for listening. And all of this is ongoing data, and we are, you know, running these studies kind of constantly. So if you think, you know, we should be doing something else, say, you should be doing something else. Shall I keep the queue?
Could I just ask a follow-up?
Please.
Is